Welcome back, everyone. Welcome back, committee members. We did have an opportunity to hang out, well, most of us did, hang out together a week ago, 2 weeks ago, over at Hamlin Mitchell. So I was able to catch up with some of you then, but not with everyone. I also want to welcome back our executive branch colleagues as we start this 2020 legislative year, and also the public that's gathered here in this room, plus the public that's viewing us online as well. We do have a new committee member, but he's not here right now, and that's, I think, due mostly to competing committees. There's a Commerce, I believe, is, no, GovOps is meeting right now.
And Commerce is at 2:30.
Okay, all right. So I did want to say, do an introduction of our new member, but I'll wait in the event that he shows, and if not, we'll do that at our next hearing. Let me just say a couple of opening comments as we start this 2020 year, just to sort of set the pace and the tone, if I may, for our work this year. One, as I've expressed with you to my colleagues on the committee in the last year, that it continues to be my privilege to chair this committee, to be about this work, and frankly, to work with each and all of you. It's been my delight, frankly, over the course of the last year, to discover the many gifts and talents and hopes that you all bring to this committee. And I know it sounds a little hyperbolic, but, you know, quite honestly, as I look at the other committees, you know, this is the committee, man. I mean, this is the committee that brings incredible talent and passion and energy to the table. And so for me, it's just a real privilege to work with each and every one of you. I want to tell you quickly, and I'd be glad to also visit with you individually. Our minority lead, Representative Johnson, and I were able to visit a bit yesterday for us to share with one another what our expectations are. But what I want to do is just tell you quickly how we're going to proceed this year, what our overall approach. And, of course, a lot of that is dictated by the fact that this is going to be a short session. It's actually a little daunting. 5 weeks from, basically around 5 weeks from now, this committee's work is should be done. So that's our second committee deadline, and we entered into that other, you know, phase, the legislature, where we're all moving our bills through the bigger process and then interacting with our colleagues on the other, across the street in the other body. My promise to you is to be as efficient as possible, to be able to get through that. We've got quite a few number of bills. I haven't looked at the introductions today, but I suspect there were a few there. If you have bills that you're introducing that we're not aware of, please come and see me and or our committee administrator, Jamal Lundy, so we can talk about our calendar, because it's actually filling up pretty quickly. I am, however, pretty hopeful about a part of that, because a good chunk of what I'm hoping that we do, or perhaps better said, redo, this year is to really avail ourselves of is a Rule 420, 420, which then allows us to address those bills that we passed last year, move forward either in Ways and Means or on the floor in the General Registry, that did not have traction at the end of last year for all sorts of reasons. And so the rule allows us to bring those back to us, and then forward them either in Ways and Means or back out to the floor. And so as we move forward, our hearings are going, should be talking with gum in my mouth. As we move forward, our hearings will involve portions of the hearing where we're going to be executing 4.20 to quickly and efficiently move those bills forward. And if there's no, you know, major objections, and if there are no, frankly, major amendments, the idea is to move those pro forma with minimal debate and discussion, because I don't want to have to re-debate and rediscuss what we did last year. And so there's going to be a number of those bills are going to move forward over the course of the next several weeks. The other thing, and I know I'm setting myself up here, and my committee minister is probably going to get upset with me, but my hope is that we minimize our evening hearings, particularly toward the latter part of our 5 weeks here. We actually did this to some success last year, but what it took was working awfully hard in the front end. And if you think about it, it's a lot easier for us to be able to do evening meetings in the first few weeks than in the latter weeks, when some of you may well be negotiating your bills that we moved out, either for floor debate or possibly as you meet with your Senate colleagues. We're going to be tugged in lots of directions. This is going to possibly be a pretty brutal session. And so if we can do our hard work and load up our hours up front, my thinking is then we'll create some flexibility and room for us to be more human as we're being increasingly taxed toward the latter part of the session. Obviously, that's also going to be dictated by the ability of each of us to be very efficient in our questioning, our debating, and our answering hearing committee. And so I want to ask you all to keep that in mind as we move forward. Have good quality debate, but also know that we've got a lot of work, a lot of ground to cover. So with that, I do see a question from Chair Costa.
Not a question, just a correction on the agenda. Today's Tuesday.
What does the agenda say? Oh, okay.
So does that mean we have an extra day?
I think we have an extra day, yeah. So we'll meet again on Tuesday, right? All right, very well. With that, why don't we get started? Today's agenda for Tuesday is to focus on bills related to probation issues and to the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We're going to begin with a presentation from the commission itself that will involve a report that they'll be providing to us, and then we're going to discuss three bills that we're not going to move today. We will put them in play, and then we're going to lay those over for further conversation. Oh, good. I can back up on my agenda. Oh, okay. All right, so let's go over that. Why don't we do that right now? Let's talk about quickly the changes for the, we spelled referral wrong too, for the referral process. So that's, I know you were going to catch me on that, Chair Cassidy. So the changes in the referral process that were negotiated out last year between the two parties here in the House. And part of that also involves a change in the corrections. I guess we would call it a subcommittee. Until then, or until now. There is a memo in your folders to the referral process, and I'm wondering, I'm kind of dialing for a friend to describe the referral process changes. Can House Research help with that? I'm sorry, I didn't give you a heads up on doing that. You know what? I'm going to put you on the spot, my committee administrator, to walk through the changes in the referral process, and then we'll talk.
From what I understand, leadership has negotiated a new referral process in which the Ways and Means will no longer be responsible for referring bills through them via memo, and as a result, bills will be referred through the General Register as has been done in the past. And so what you can expect is for bills to take a little longer in moving throughout the process, as they will have to be motioned through the floor to the next committee.
Pretty much a process that we've been using for a number of years. We've gone back and forth over time, but I think for most of my years here, this is the process that we primarily have been using. Okay, and then the impact on the subcommittee, so Chair Considine, it's your committee, is really that unless there's a finance issue connected to a bill, which then would require it to come back through this, the finance committee, and then onward to Ways and Means, if we're dealing with policy provisions, then you're going to be receiving those bills directly and then motioning those bills forward as well. Obviously, the chair of this committee could also ask for those bills to be seen. So, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had read the email regarding to what you just said, and since I'm deleted corrections, I was a little confused. Can you just clarify again to make sure I understand? So if a bill goes as introduced to the corrections committee, it gets a hearing, then is it motioned? It could go as a suggested motion to your committee, but does it have to go through the floor for a floor vote and then officially to your committee? Is that the process? Just like what we've used for 20 years.
Yeah, yes, you know, quite simply, yeah. So we would still pull it if we wanted it, but we'd have to go through the floor to be able to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It was confusing in the email. It kind of skipped that part, but we will have motions and voting on the floor in order to move a bill officially.
Yeah. You know what? We'll clarify that email if that's confusing. It's important that we all know the rules that we're operating under. Chair Consonant.
We'll go slowly to make sure everybody is. I found it a little confusing also when I first led it, so we'll probably go slowly and make sure everybody's on the same page before we do anything.
Very well. So with that, I'm going to back up with my comments because we do have a new member here. Our speaker appointed a new member to our committee because we were down one member. As opposed to me belaboring, I'm just first of all, welcome you, sir, to our body, and invite you to share a little bit about you, who you are, and your interest in this work before us.
My name's Paul Novotny, the new representative from 30A. I've lived in Elk River all my life. I have been in law enforcement and worked for the Sherman County Sheriff's Office for 31 years next week, and 33 years total. I'll be retiring from the sheriff's office at the end of May, and my wife and my mother were here at the swearing in. I've got two daughters that are both away. They're 18 and 21, and I'm happy to be here.
Well, welcome, sir, and thank you for your service in law enforcement over the last few decades. Why don't we do this, members, because I'm not sure you've met everyone yet. If we can just take a couple of minutes and go around the room very quickly, state our name, our district, and what communities those involved, and perhaps Representative Long, I'll start with you.
Sure. Representative Jamie Long, Southwest Minneapolis, District 61B.
And State Representative Dave Pinto from District 64B, which is the southwest part of St. Paul. Welcome. Glad to have you.
Jack Considine, 19B, and I understand that you've also been appointed to the Corrections Reform Committee. Welcome to that. I'm retired from the Blue Earth County Sheriff's Office.
Shelley Christensen, 39B, the St. Croix Valley area, Lake Elmo, Grant Township.
Kelly Moeller, 42A, Shoreview, Mounds View, Arden Hills. Welcome.
excuse me, Raymond Dean, District 59B, representing most of downtown Minneapolis and the southern part of North Minneapolis.
Let's do the staff.
Ellen McDaniel, and I'm with the DFL Caucus Research Department.
John Walls, House Fiscal Staff.
Ben Johnson, House Research.
Jason Chavez, Committee Legislative Assistant.
I will study out in from 65B, which is part of St. Paul.
Jamal Lundy, Committee Administrator.
Heather Edelson, 49A Edina.
Jeff Diebel, Nonpartisan House Research.
Brian Johnson, Isani County, 27 years of law enforcement.
John Hultquist, House GOP Research Staff.
Representative John Poston, District 9A.
Tim Miller, 17A, Swift Chip, almost Renville, a little bit of Kennewick County.
John Lesh, 66B, St. Paul, North Central Part of St. Paul.
Eric Lucero, 30B, and I think there's general consensus the better side of Senate District 30.
It's going to be fun. You're
down. I'm sorry, I disagree. Marion O'Neill, state rep from 29B, which is Buffalo, Monticello, Maple Lake. You are across the Mississippi River from me.
Very well. Thank you for that. Again, welcome, sir, to this committee. We didn't start at the time we wanted to start for all the appropriate reasons, but I just want to give a time check so we all have know what the expectation is. We had hoped for about an hour and a half meeting here today. So I'm looking around 3 o'clock, a little bit after 3 o'clock for us to adjourn. I think we should be able to do that. I do know that some committee members are on GovOps. Representative Howard has an important bill up in that committee right now, so he can't be with us right now. Some of you may also be serving in GovOps, and of course, Commerce is starting sometime soon. If some of you serve in Commerce. Please feel free to, if you need to go to those committees. And Representative Devine, you're on one of those committees, is that right? Oh, okay. All right, very well. So we have some bills before us, but we're not going to be moving those. So don't feel the pressure to get back or to vote on those bills. Obviously, I want you here as much as possible, but if you have duties and obligations in those other committees, please feel free to leave the table and join your colleagues in that committee. So with that, we're going to get started. And first up on the agenda is a presentation by the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. And I believe we have two public servants with us here today. I'll let them introduce themselves as they come forward to give their presentation. You know, and before you do that, let me do this. We have minutes from our hearing, from two hearings, our most recent hearings, and Chair Considine, one of them involves
Chair Mariani. These were not official meetings, so minutes were not needed, but we do need to get the minutes from the last markup meeting on the omnibus bill last year to pass them.
Very well. President Johnson, why don't we have those ready for us to act on Thursday? And then we did. I see. All right. So my understanding is that the House tells us we should adopt these in order to then incorporate them into our official record.
So moved.
So, Representative Johnson, you're and Representative Considine, we have 2 minutes. So you're moving adoption of the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Corrections Division meeting, and is there a date? On January 29th.
That is correct.
Very well. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion approved. And Representative Edelson, if you would be so kind to move the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Division joint hearing from January 29th. I'd appreciate it.
So moved, Chair.
All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you. Thank you, members. Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thanks for having us today. I'm Kelly Mitchell, and I am currently the Chair of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. In my day job, I'm also Executive Director of the Robina Institute of Criminal Law and Criminal Justice. I'm joined here by Nate Rice, who is the Executive Director for the Commission. And we're going to kind of tag team the whole way through, and I hope that that's okay with you, Mr. Chair.
Sounds wonderful.
Okay, great.
We've selected four topics to discuss with you today.
And I'm sorry, you are going to have to
identify yourself. I am Nate Rice. I'm the executive director. Yes. So we've selected four topics to discuss with you today in the hopes that they'll be relevant to the issues that you're considering in committee. today. We'd first like to talk about the structure and purpose of the commission. Second, we'd like to talk about the commission's budget situation. Third, we'd like to give you some highlights of the report to the legislature that we sent to you last month. And Representative Novotny, we can forward a copy of that to you. And finally, we'd like to go into some detail about the new probation length guideline that the commission has submitted to the legislature. So let's begin with a review of the commission's history and structure. 42 years ago, the Minnesota legislature established the first sentencing guidelines commission in the nation. It gave the commission six responsibilities in its charter statute, and those responsibilities have remained essentially unchanged to this day. The first three responsibilities had to do with the sentencing guidelines. The commission was to establish the sentencing guidelines, it was to meet as necessary for modifying and improving the sentencing guidelines, and to keep the legislature informed as to those modifications and improvements, or proposed modifications, as the case might be. But the legislature's vision for the commission was broader than simply establishing sentencing guidelines. The legislature viewed the commission and its staff as being a potentially valuable information resource for the state. So the commission was tasked to serve as a clearinghouse and information center for state and local sentencing practices data, some of which we'll share with you in a minute. It was required to conduct ongoing research into various matters related to the improvement of the criminal justice system, and it was required to periodically make recommendations to the legislature on the improvement of criminal law and procedure, one of which we'll also discuss in a minute. So let's now spend a minute talking about what those sentencing guidelines were supposed to look like. First, the legislature required the sentencing guidelines to have two main features. These mandatory features were that they were to establish the circumstances under which imprisonment was proper, and for cases where imprisonment was proper, they were to establish a presumptive prison sentence. Those presumptive sentences were to be based on reasonable offense and offender characteristics. And those features were required of the sentencing guidelines that the commission was to promulgate. In addition, however, the legislature gave the commission an optional grant of authority. The commission was authorized but not required to establish within its guidelines appropriate sanctions for offenders for whom imprisonment was not proper. Such non-imprisonment guidelines could be broad in scope and were explicitly authorized to include probation and the conditions thereof.
So, three years after the guidelines were put in place, the commission was tasked with evaluating how they were working. And one of the things, if you go back to that 1984 study, one of the things that the commission really talked about was how this state had set up the commission how they had set up the grant of authority between the commission, the legislature, and judges. So the legislature would establish broad policy standards by defining crimes and establishing maximum punishments. The commission would work within those broad policy standards and develop advisory sentencing guidelines for the district court subject to legislative review. And judges would impose real-time sentences for felons, and with their departure authority under the guidelines, they could individualize those sentences based on the unique characteristics of the offense or on the individual who was being sentenced. So we have this sort of structure that works across all three of those actors within the system.
That same report also describes, thank you, Mr. Chair, the same report also describes the makeup of the commission as being designed to represent both the criminal justice system and the public. Three members, all of whom are appointed by the Chief Justice, represent and I should say this is the current makeup, not the makeup as it was back in the 1980s, but three members represent the three levels of the Minnesota court system, and those are all appointed by the Chief Justice. The other eight members are appointed by the governor. Two members represent opposite sides in a criminal court case, the prosecution and the defense. Three members represent the criminal justice system in effect before and after the criminal court case, police, probation, and the Department of Corrections. Finally, three members represent the public, including one of whom who must be a felony crime victim.
So with that, we've briefly reviewed the design of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, its terms. In terms of its purpose, the legislative distribution of sentencing authority to the commission and to its membership. And you might ask, well, why did the legislature set the commission up in this way? This is how a University of Minnesota professor, Richard Fraze, summed it up when he did a 25-year review of the commission. He said a major goal of a guideline system designed and monitored by an independent sentencing commission is to ensure that sentencing policy formulation and modification is data-driven, comprehensive across crimes and judicial districts, and insulated from short-term political pressures.
Are we waiting until the end for questions?
Chair Lesh, I would prefer that we be added. Thank you. But we'll put you on the list for sure.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to spend a minute talking about the agency's budget. I have asked the governor's office to support a deficiency request of $8,000 in the current fiscal year and $36,000 in fiscal year 2021 and thereafter. The reason for this request is that the agency is experiencing unexpected personnel compensation costs that were not included in the enacted budget, and the purpose of the request is to avoid personnel layoffs. Personnel compensation costs have historically made up about 90% of this agency's budget, so unexpected changes to compensation have a major impact on our ability to operate. These compensation costs are beyond this agency's control. We literally have the same number of people, and the people are shown on the blue line of this chart, with the dots. We literally have the same number of people in exactly the same positions that we had in 2012. No new positions have been added since that time, and no one has been promoted to a higher position. As the green line shows, our efficiency has improved as we have been able to support the work of the commission with an historically low number of staff per 10,000 felony cases sentenced annually. We now have 3.3 staff per 10,000 cases. In the next several slides, we're going to breeze through some of the highlights of the report to the legislature that we sent to you on January 15th. We will be very brief, but we would be happy to return to your committee, Mr. Chair, at any time, or the Corrections Subcommittee to take a deeper dive into any of the issues discussed. In each annual report, we take the opportunity to tell you about the Commission's activities in the previous year. The Commission made several changes to the sentencing guidelines in 2019, most notably, some changes to how criminal history scores are calculated. And we talked to you about that last year in our report to the legislature. And those took effect in August. The commission is also proposing to make changes to the 2020 sentencing guidelines, also to take an effect in August, the most notable of which is a five-year cap on the length of probation, a presumptive cap, which we'll be discussing in a few minutes. As we discussed earlier, you have invited the commission to make recommendations to you regarding crime policy. The commission has one such recommendation to you this year, to define a minimum term of imprisonment for people sentenced to life imprisonment for murder of an unborn child in the first degree. The minimum term of imprisonment for this was deleted, apparently inadvertently, by the 1989 legislature. This has not been an issue yet because this offense is rarely committed, and it's always been committed, accompanied, regrettably, by the murder of the mother. But the commission recommends resolving this problem before it does become an issue in a particular case. Finally, you instructed the commission last year to review how it ranks child pornography offenses compared to other sex offenses, and the commission is currently in the process of conducting that review. The commission monitors, we're now going to talk about sentencing practices data, and we can spend a lot longer than one slide talking about this, but here goes. So we monitor sentencing practices for felony offenses sentenced throughout the state. We saw a record volume of felony sentences, felony cases sentenced in 2017, and 2018 was very nearly as high. It was almost flat, but it was four cases lower, so it went down a hair. 2018 saw the number of drug cases go down for the first time since 2010. Although after years of significant growth, the number of drug cases sentenced in 2018 was still 66% higher than the number of cases sentenced in 2010. So we saw a 66% increase from 2010 to 2018, even though there was a decrease from 2017 to 2018. For the first time ever, women accounted for 20% of the case volume in 2018. So women have never broken that 20% barrier before, but Or to put it another way, men have always exceeded 80% of the case volume. But that changed in 2018. Another interesting statistic was that in 38.3% of the cases in which the sentencing guidelines recommended a prison sentence, the defendant was instead given a stayed sentence. This is called a mitigated dispositional departure. And this is the highest mitigated dispositional departure rate we have ever seen. For two common offenses, second degree assault and first degree burglary, the mitigated dispositional departure rate actually exceeded 50%. As I said before, I would be happy to get into details of the data to include the differences in departure rates by gender, race, ethnicity, and geography at your convenience. This year's report to the legislature has a special section on the impact of the 2016 Drug Sentencing Reform Act, or DSRA, which is something the legislature required the commission to look at in particular. We compared the post-DSRA cases sentenced through 2018, so cases that were committed on or after August 1st of 2016 and sentenced through the end of 2018, and we compared them with a comparable group of pre-DSRA cases. We found that the post-DSRA group was significantly larger than the pre-DSRA group, which really shouldn't be surprising given the rise in drug cases that we've seen over time. But it should be noted that the difference would have been even more significant, so the rise would have been even bigger if it were not for the fact that the DSRA took a number of cases that would have been felony cases, but because they were first-time possession of a trace amount, they became gross misdemeanor cases. That was one of the features of the DSRA, that there was a gross misdemeanor version of the fifth-degree offense. So this case volume would have been even larger but for the DSRA. Even though there were more cases in the post-DSRA group, we found that the post-DSRA cases required 7% fewer estimated prison beds than the pre-DSRA group. In fact, when we applied 2015 sentencing practices to the post-DSRA group and tried to estimate what their sentences would have been, we found that the post-DSRA group cases would have required well over 1,000 more estimated prison beds than they did. So we have found evidence that the DSRA both saved and avoided the need for prison beds. Some drug offenses can be enhanced in severity if committed in a school zone or a park zone and so forth. Although the use of such zone enhancements in Minnesota is fairly uncommon, we found that prosecutors overall, and particularly prosecutors in some regions, have increased the use of zone enhancements post-DSRA. We also found that stays of adjudication have become more popular after the DSRA changes, and that was an intentional feature of the DSRA. As we have previously reported to you, methamphetamine continues to dominate Minnesota's drug scene, comprising 64.5% of post-DSRA felonies. The next section of our report to the legislature is reporting not on our data, but data that's required to be reported to us by each of the 87 county attorneys in the state. They're required to report the disposition of cases that are allegedly firearms cases for which the mandatory minimums of Section 60911 apply. In fiscal year 2019, the county attorneys reported disposing of 1,274 such cases, which is a record high. Going through the pipeline, only 767 of those cases were cases in which the defendant was convicted of an applicable offense and the firearm was established on the record. In those cases where the mandatory minimum did apply, county attorneys reported that the mandatory minimum was actually imposed and executed in 458 of those cases. And I should say that although it's called a mandatory minimum, the statute specifically authorizes prosecutors or judges on their own to waive the mandatory minimum, which is either 3 or 5 years in prison.
So the change that received the most attention this past year was the modification to the Sentencing Guidelines Commission made to create a probation guideline. As we discussed earlier, establishing guidelines for non-prison sentences was one of our original delegations of authority. In the early days of the guidelines, the commission formally considered actually establishing these non-imprisonment guidelines on several occasions. So when you think about 1978, 1979, 80, when the guidelines were first established, the commission had pretty much all it could do to create a grid, create a whole new system, and get something on the table. So they didn't put non-imprisonment sanctions in the original set of guidelines, but they kept talking about it. In 1982 and 83, they decided against imposing jail guidelines, and jail is the shorter period of time that's served locally when a person is given a probation sentence. The discussion continued. In 1988 and 1989, at the legislature's directive, the commission considered but decided against a host of other types of non-imprisonment guidelines, including structuring probation lengths. And if you read those old reports, you know, one of the things you can glean from them is that there was a real concern by the commission about sort of over-legislating in this area, because probation sentences are very different than prison sentences. They are much more individualized. It's more difficult to set an overarching policy that gets at, you know, the types of conditions that need to be imposed for a specific individual based on the kind of crime that they committed, what their criminogenic needs are, what factors cause them to offend in the first place, what programming we might have available that we could use to help them keep from reoffending in the future and to sort of get on a more successful footing. So it doesn't make a lot of sense to have guidelines for most of the factors that go into a probation sentence. But that doesn't mean that that the commission ever sort of let that idea drop altogether, because over the years, the issue has come up repeatedly. Several years ago, for example, the Senate, when Senator Latz was chair of the Senate committee, he created an advisory group to advise the legislature on whether or not we should have an earned compliance policy, because we were already recognizing that we had really large probation populations. And that group, using data provided by the Sentencing Commission, really couldn't, basically had to tell the legislature, we can't do a policy like that because the probation terms that are imposed across the state vary so widely that we can't come up with a fair way to do earned compliance, because some people would still get off way early and some people would be working forever to try to get to half of their sentence if that was the way that we structured a policy like that. The commission again started to revisit this issue in 2018 and 2019 when it was working on its criminal history score. The commission did a full review of that score and came up against probation terms again when they were trying to look at the decay policy, whether or not an offense that's very old should continue to count in the criminal history score of the individual when they come forward. And the varying lengths of probation were really impacting the way that the decay policy was being implemented across the state. So the commission came up with this very wacky, weird workaround way to try to account for all those differences in probation terms, but they weren't really able to move the needle much and continued to be concerned that probation lengths were a problem. So it was no surprise that the commission kept talking about it and came up with and decided to do something about it this time around directly after they had dealt with all of those other issues. So the commission has over time at multiple points in time studied the wide geographical variation in pronounced periods of probation. Here's just an example, this chart that's up on the screen right now shows that from 2016 to 2018, for people who were convicted of drug offenses, the probation terms varied from about 3 years in the 4th and the 6th judicial districts, that's Minneapolis and St. Paul, I'm sorry, Minneapolis and Duluth area, to about 8 years in the 3rd district and 9 years in the 7th district. So these types of things really concerned us as we were looking at probation, as we were looking at this issue. So as the commission continued to study the issue, we learned a couple of things. So first of all, the overall revocation rate for people who are on probation is about 18%. So a lot of people are actually successful on probation. But if a revocation is going to occur, it's most likely that it's going to happen during the first 2 years of probation. Only about 1% of probationers are revoked after 5 years. This is commission data at putting on my Robina hat. We've also done recidivism research, and we know that the first year and a half is the most likely point where if there's going to be a new felony offense committed, it's going to happen within that first year and a half. That's the highest risk point for new felonies. So new felonies within the first year and a half, new revocations within the first 2 years, that's where the most of it happens. So the long probation terms just really aren't giving us the sort of public safety benefit, bang for our buck, that we thought that they were. So with all of this in mind, the commission did vote at its November meeting to put a probation cap in place. In December, we held a public hearing on that to get input as to that policy choice. 31 people testified at the public hearing. 63 people submitted written comments following that public hearing. Some of those were the same people in both places. Most of the comments were in favor of enacting probation guidelines. And some comments offered constructive suggestions for improving the policy. So when we came back into session in January, the commission did actually enact a policy that was a little bit different than what we had initially envisioned back in November. And this is how it works. So unless the legislature by law provides otherwise, the probation guideline that we put in place will go into effect August 1st of 2020. There will be a presumptive limit of 5 years for felony probation lengths, but it's not a hard cap. We're working within the statutory maximums that the legislature has set. We're saying that our guideline is that probation should be up to 5 years, but that the court has the ability to depart and impose a longer probation term if there are substantial and compelling reasons to do so. And just like the proposal that this committee passed out last year, the guideline will not apply to homicide or criminal sexual conduct offenses. So I think that covers everything that we wanted to cover today, and we can stand for questions.
That's a lot of ground, and we're going to start putting members' names down. And I've got some questions, too. And so, members, what I'd like to do is ask the commission chair and director to stay at the table, because I want to get at one of the parts. You had a 3-4 part presentation, and I want to just get one part quickly out of the way, which has to do with the budget recommendation. So, members, if you bear with me, what I'd like to do then is to move House File 3156 be referred to Ways and Means. And this this motion, or this proposal, would then address the issue relative to the shortfall that the commission is currently facing. So it's pretty straightforward. I believe it's structured at $8,000 shortfall in 2020. And $36,000 shortfall for 2021. And I would like Director Reitz just to say a few words more about the importance of that appropriation, and particularly, I think you already said this, but I think for the record, we have to build up whether we're doing something additional with those funds, or what is it that these funds will cover and allow the commission to do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These would avoid layoffs, which would have both an impact on the functioning of the commission's work and I think would have a negative effect on our ability to retain and recruit the high-quality personnel that we currently have. Yeah, so this is simply to maintain existing operations, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right, so my intent is to lay this over, we won't be taking a vote on this, but I do want to open up for any questions that committee members may have, Director Reitz, on this issue of the budget. Representative Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a really quick question. If this appropriation isn't made, what is your game plan?
Director Reitz.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I am, my understanding is that before I go into detailed layoff planning, I have to go through certain steps, including talking with the unions and that sort of thing. So I haven't done that detailed layoff planning. My estimate is that we could restrict layoffs to the month of June for this fiscal year, but it would be pretty widespread during the month of June. It would be much more severe than that in fiscal year 2021, possibly as much as an entire staff member.
Okay.
Senator Paulson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Chair Mariani. Mr. Grove, could you explain what some of the drivers were for the budget shortfall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, it's increased compensation costs. I don't, we got those compensation costs from our, we get HR services from the Department of Corrections, and those are the numbers that they gave us. I don't know all the drivers in detail. I believe I know what some of them were. I know that the some of them have to do with the labor contracts that were negotiated. I'm not an expert on that, and I can't speak with great authority about what exactly drove the increased compensation costs in terms of that $8,000 and the $36,000. I'm sorry, I can't answer that question.
Senator Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I guess since we're laying this over, I can accept that answer now, but I guess in the future, if we could find out what those cost drivers are so we can try to deal with them.
I think it's appropriate. Any other questions on Representative Levy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of a comment. And, you know, I was the chair of the Subcommittee on Employee Relations that reviews all the state employee contracts. And this was a concern that I raised repeatedly. And historically, when I looked at the numbers and crunched all the numbers, when the contracts were presented to the Subcommittee on Employee Relations and to the legislature as a whole, certain numbers were provided as to what those contracts would cost. So they were estimations of cost. And in some instances, when the actuals came in, these are very large contracts for state employees. It's $11 billion of money for the state employee contracts. And they came in 40% higher than was presented to the legislature in some of the largest contracts in the years that I looked at it. So I'd like to point out again that here we are again with negotiated contracts by MMB, and now the agency is coming in and saying we have a shortfall, we have a deficit. This is a pattern at the legislature, and I think it's something that needs to get a better handle on it. This is a very small example. I mean, we're only talking $36,000, but we're talking millions and millions of dollars statewide. So I just wanted to make that comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well. Thank you, Representative O'Neill. I want to reflect members that these numbers are, while they're important to the commission itself, because we're not talking about a big entity here, even though the work is vital, these are relatively small numbers compared to perhaps the bigger issue that you're wanting to address, Representative. So with that, I see no further questions, and I'm going to lay over House File 3156, and then we're going to get into questions. Was there someone else? Okay. We're going to get into some questions then. I have a list, but very quickly, Director Wrights, and these don't have to be lengthy, but just very quick. So on page 6, where we've got the ongoing work related to the guidelines treating child pornography offenses. Any indication of when, what kind of timeline or window you're looking at relative to arriving at some recommendations and suggestions relative to that?
Mr. Chair, I don't have a clear answer for you. I doubt that we'll have anything this session, and it's a short session, so I don't know that it would be helpful if we did, but just based on the pace at which we're going, it's the commission's doing a very thorough examination into it, and I think once they're done with the examination, it's going to take them a while to sort of compile the information to discuss it. So I would maybe the chair has a different opinion, but I think it's not out of the question that it would be ready for next session.
And Director Wrights, I have been at one or two meetings where I've sat in for parts to listen to some of the discussion and debate, and I just want to reiterate that I think the commission is, in fact, there are a lot of difficult issues here, and the commission is, I think, being very deliberate and smart about trying to work through that. So I'm not surprised. But obviously, as a legislator, we have to ask the question. And then on the same page where we show the 2018 sentencing practices data, so we have the quick data. This could be a much longer conversation, so I might tend to do this, but just very quickly, where we have women accounted for 20% of case volume for the first time ever, that catches my attention. Maybe if you can give us a little bit of reference where that has been, and particularly, so it's 20% relative to what last year, the year before, and whether anything you could say about trends or growth, or is it an anomaly, or, and I'm only asking you to guess. I'm not asking for, but just some insight.
Mr. Chair, I would say it's a point on a trend rather than an anomaly. It's been a gradual rise for a long time.
All right. Very well. And then my final quick question on the next page, when we get into the DSRA, and we're looking at the the big changes relative to the first time possession of trace amounts. So we've got, the estimation that that without those changes would have required 1,000 more prison beds. So, and again, this is it could be a much deeper dive, but just a quick, sharing. What is happening with those different convictions? What is our system doing relative to them? Are there alternative treatment programs? Are there extended, supervision? Just a quick indication of how we're then adjusting to what would have been folks filling 1,000 prison beds.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The I can unfortunately only answer your question in fairly crude terms. Some people are going to prison for less time than they would have gone if they had been sentenced in 2015. Some are not going to prison but instead being placed on probation, and some are not being convicted of felonies at all but are being convicted of gross misdemeanors, and some are receiving stays of adjudication where they would have received a conviction. So it's really a combination of all four of those.
Well, one of the things that triggers for me is this committee's particular interest in providing alternatives and intervention work. And so I don't know, but it begs this question of whether we should be doubling down on those kind of investments and efforts on the part of the state. But I look forward to a deeper conversation relative to this data set. So with that, members, so those are my very quick questions. Representative Dean, you've got to head out to a committee, so I've got you on the list.
Yeah, and this is, Mr. Chair, my question is related to this particular area as well, the DSRA. So, Director Reitz, I mean, remember when we were talking about this, there was a lot of discussion about retroactivity and going back for those individuals that they were sentenced under the old guidelines, how they would be impacted under the new guidelines. And it's been a couple of years now. So have we begun to move beyond those individuals that we didn't go back and change their sentence? I mean, have most of them served what would have been their sentence now, and they're either one out in public or, hopefully not, but they've committed new offenses and they're now back in being line. Can you give us an estimate of that?
I can't. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Dean. I don't know. That's a really interesting question. I'm sure we could come up with an answer on that, like how many people are currently serving particularly prison sentences who would benefit from the DSRA's impact. I mean, there might be some because the first-degree offenses were the sentences were pretty lengthy. So I can't give you an answer. It's an interesting question. Obviously, the number is dwindling as time elapses, but there may be some people who would benefit from a retroactivity taking place now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize after I have to ask this question. I'm doing committee as well over in commerce and taxes, but can you help me understand the framework of sentencing law prior to 1978? Was there a framework? I know it was indeterminate, okay, but was that at the discretion of judges? What were we looking at? And we very rarely talk about that, so... I started thinking about that when you started off in your presentation.
Ms. Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, prior to the enactment of the sentencing guidelines, we actually had a parole system in Minnesota. And so what that meant is that when a person was sentenced for a felony, the court would usually pronounce a range, like 0 to 10, you know, some sort of wide range. And it was up to the parole board to review that person's case to determine when release would be appropriate. So that's the system we were working under. A little harder to sort of project prison populations, where things would go. Honestly, Minnesota was a little ahead of the curve because our parole board developed parole guidelines, which gave them sort of a rubric and a framework to think about what an appropriate sentence would be for someone to actually serve. And that that served as sort of a starting point for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission when they started to think about how should we frame up sentencing on the front end.
Thank you so much, Ms. Chair. And was that framework codified anywhere, or was it merely kind of suggestive?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, no, it wasn't codified. That was something that the parole board created for themselves. For their own use. So it was subject to the whims. It could be changed at will.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming there were certainly a mess of laws that did have frameworks. Anytime there's a big issue around here, we come in and say make a mandatory minimum or something. I'm certain there were certain mandatory minimums codified somewhere. Is that true?
Mitchell.
Chair Mariani and Representative Lesh, I'd have to do a little digging, but I think most of our mandatory minimums were created in the 90s. And so our parole system would have preceded that. And so back then, the biggest signal that the court would have and the parole board would have as to how serious the offense was and what the punishment should be would be the statutory maximum punishment that the legislature established, which is kind of what the guidelines use today as well.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lesh. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Mr. Grove, I got a couple different questions. Dealing with the new proposal that's supposed to take effect later this year. One issue I have concerns about is on the Schnell proposal, it doesn't factor in criminal history score. So you could have a criminal history of a person that's done a repeat offender could do a first degree assault, and a first time offender doing a fourth degree assault, and they'd be doing the same time, 5 years. And also, I'm just trying to figure out what the rationale behind that was. And also, if a judge did decide to go outside that 5 year presumptive cap, what is the process for that judge has to go through? And if you're making this, does that supersede the judge's authority by you doing that?
Chair Mariani and Representative Johnson, if I don't hit all your questions, make sure I do at the end. Okay, so first of all, why don't we use criminal history as one of the factors for setting the probation term? One of the reasons why this guideline is a little different than the way we would set prison is because there are so many other considerations that go into probation. It's really difficult on the front end to figure out what the appropriate what an appropriate, or it's really difficult, I'm sorry, not on the front end, it's really difficult from where we sit without looking at the individual case to determine what an appropriate length of probation would be for that individual case. And that's because the way that probation works in Minnesota is according to a risk, needs, and responsivity framework. So individuals are assessed for risk to reoffend and their criminogenic needs, which are the things that we can work on with them to help them change their behavior so that they don't reoffend in the future. Now, the type of programming that you might need to implement to help somebody work on those criminogenic needs could vary, and it could take longer or shorter depending on the types of things that they need to work on, whether that is substance abuse treatment, whether they have an antisocial personality, they need cognitive behavioral therapy. These are the kinds of things that a judge, though, can look at and understand at the time of sentencing, how much time do I need to impose so that this person can actually get this stuff done within the time frame that we have. Criminal history has nothing to do with that. A person with a zero criminal history score and a person with a criminal history score of 6 could have the same criminogenic needs and might need the same programming. So criminal history is not a good indicator for what a probation length should be. So that's why this particular guideline is written as a range. It's 0 to 5 years. We also wanted to be able to allow places like Hennepin and Duluth to keep their sort of 3-year policy so that they could, so that they didn't need to push up to 5. If 3 is working for their population without affecting crime rates, then they should continue with 3. So those are the reasons why we needed a more flexible framework for probation. Let's see, what should the judge go through was the next question, I think. So if the judge wants to impose a probation term that's longer than 5 years, under this guideline, it would be a departure. So that means that the judge has to articulate substantial and compelling reasons why a longer probation term is warranted in this case. Substantial and compelling is the standard that we have for all departures under the sentencing guidelines. So it's a standard that's very familiar to the court and very familiar to probation, to prosecutors and defense attorneys as well. I don't know what particular reasons judges are going to articulate to justify the longer terms, but I'm sure that they're out there, and we will figure that out through the court process. It's possible that we may have to use the Blakely procedures that we have in the state for aggravated sentencing, and that just means that the prosecutor's got some more duties up front. They have to sort of signal to the court that they would like to consider a longer probation term. They have to give the defense attorney notice of that. And then those particular reasons that might justify the longer term would be eligible for a jury trial if the defendant so chooses. But under our current process, the defendant also has the ability to waive the right to that jury trial and often does when we are in an aggravated sentencing circumstance. So that's sort of the process. I hope that's understandable. And did I hit all the questions, or is there something else? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions, and the first one is sort of a follow-up to that question about the criminal history score and whether or not it impacts probation. But it's my understanding of the grid that the criminal history score can actually take someone out of the presumptive stay land into presumptive commit land. So the criminal history score really is being considered, especially when you're comparing what's a presumptive stay to what's a presumptive commit. Is my understanding of that correct?
Chair Mariani and Representative Mueller, yes, you're absolutely correct. This guideline does not change the effect of the dispositional line, so a person's criminal history score will still be relevant under the guidelines to put them in the right box on the grid. That determines whether it's a probation sentence or a presumptive prison sentence.
Thank you. Correct. Mr. Chair?
So we still have a couple questions. I know Representative Johnson also wants to ask a follow-up question, perhaps. But I'm just watching the time and managing that. And so, Representative Juan, what I want to do is the same thing that we did just with my bill a little earlier, which is to bring that bill up. It's not going to at all interrupt the questions that you have teed up. What I'd like to do is have Representative Juan, and you two can stay there. It's fine, because obviously, you know, it's on point. But if Representative Juan can present his bill, and then we'll jump right to the questions that are still in line, already to have Considine and Representative Johnson. Again, I think the questions are going to be pretty much in line with you already have teed up, and Representative O'Neill as well. So Representative Long moves House File 689 be referred to, and I believe this will be our new way of doing things, to the General Registry. And so Representative Long, you have House File 689 before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have a delete all amendment as well.
And you wish like to move that then? So Representative Law moves the DE amendment to House File 689, puts a bill in the shape that Representative Long wishes it to be deliberated on today. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. 689 is now amended with the DE amendment. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we heard the underlying bill on five-year sentencing. Five-year probation cap. Last year, we passed that out of the House. It was not acted on in the Senate, as we know. I applaud the action of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission for moving forward with their proposal, and would certainly be open if the Senate is interested in revisiting the bill to have that discussion. But the delete all amendment just does one simple thing, which is take care of one anomaly that couldn't be fixed by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission under their authority, which is to deal with the situation where we have a mismatch between gross misdemeanors and felonies of 6 and 5 years, respectively, for criminal vehicular operation. And so this bill is designed to fix that. Hopefully we could at least all agree that that would be something we can take care of, even if we can't get to the larger question this year about the legislature making permanent these changes, but hoping we can do that. This also has a discharge provision in here that has a formal grant of authority to discharge probation when the individual has completed all the conditions of probation. Some judges are doing this currently via their inherent judicial authority, but some are unsure whether they have this authority, and this, I think, would address one of the concerns raised in the minority report regarding varying the severity of punishment with the offense. And we think this would, I believe this would help codify and clarify that probation sentences are different than incarceration sentences, and that the period of time needed for supervision isn't always clear up front. And when a person does what we've asked them to do, I think that discharge is appropriate. But with that, those are my remarks.
Very well. Ms. Mitchell, Director Wright's thoughts on 689 as amended language?
Chair Mariani, the Sentencing Guidelines Commission has not yet talked about this. We actually have it on our agenda for Thursday, so we will tell you our official stance after Thursday.
All right, very well. We will be laying this over, so that will give us opportunity then to benefit from your deliberations on the commission. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, since you brought up these other bills, I had questions on that bill. I had further questions on the Sentencing Guidelines Commission that we're
absolutely
working on.
Absolutely.
I'll go to the long bill at this time and deal with this issue that I have with that one. One of the best court systems that we have, the best specialty courts we have, is the drug courts. They work fantastic. I have a bad feeling that this proposal is going to end that success rate that they have. Down in Winona, when we're down there for the mini session, I can't remember the judge's name that's in charge of the drug courts down there. Had a nice conversation with her and learned that once a person stops using the narcotics, it takes up to 18 months just for the brain, the dopamine's in the brain, to get back to working somewhat normal. Now, you do a 2-year probation, now you're looking at less than 6 months to get things changed around and keep them in check. That's if they haven't used a single drug since they were originally sentenced. If they use it one time, that 18 months goes long. If they use it 11 months into their probation, and there's a 2-year cap, the brain's not even working properly, and they're off probation. So this is going to be a great detriment to that system. The drug courts, they intentionally have a much longer probation time listed to make sure things are right. But when the person's working right, and every probation officer can do it now, they just go to the judge and the person can be released and discharged from probation once they've made that point. It could be 4 years in. It could be 6 years in on a 10-year probation. It might take all 10 years. It might take three. But when the timing is right, the probation officer has the authority to go before the judge to release them now. And unfortunately, we don't have the capabilities, and it's never been tracked, how many times somebody's on probation is released early. I actually have a bill on my desk I'm going to be dropping for that purpose, so we can find out how long people are actually on probation. That's one major concern I have with this.
So let's zero in on that particularly. And I wasn't there at the commission during the testimony, but I know that a good chunk of what came forward was driven by data and experiences, including experience and data that came from probation officers themselves. So I'm wondering, Ms. Mitchell, if you can comment relative to this issue in terms of what the data in social science is telling us and whether or not, in fact, there were some deliberations about this particular issue as you mulled over the recommendations.
Thank you, Chair Mirani and Representative Johnson. I think that, you know, on the drug court side, if the issue is that the person is not successfully making it through treatment, then under current law, we do have the ability to increase the length of probation for failure to complete treatment. So that's there today, and our proposal won't change that, so that tool will still be available to the court. I don't have numbers on what like the average time is for somebody to make it through drug court, and I think it would be great to get those numbers to sort of answer your question very directly, but I'm afraid I don't have those. But we did talk informally to folks like out in Washington County. They're working on the dosage probation program, you know, because we were concerned about having enough time to allow for the programs like that to work. And the feedback that we got was that 5 years would be enough. So I don't think we're going to undermine those programs, but certainly we could look at more data to answer your question directly.
That would be good. I'm wondering, Ms. Mitchell, if anything's been changed relative to failure to comply with probation terms, because it seems to me this touches potentially on that as well.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your text.
Failure to comply probation terms after 5 years.
Are you talking specifically about drug court, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, my understanding of it's very difficult to get data about drug courts from the judicial branch because of the treatment component and the privacy implications of that. So we've got very little information from the judicial branch. That's my understanding. I'd have to research to know more, but I think that's true.
Yeah, I was really more focused on the the circumstances where there's just failure to comply. So there are terms here relative to someone, accessing illicit drugs. So has that changed now in terms of failure to comply under the proposal or the proposal under the guidelines issued by the commission?
I'm hearing your question correctly, and I'm sorry I should have put my hearing aid in today, but I forgot. I don't think that changes there's nothing that our proposal does that would change that. And if failure to comply with treatment is the issue, are you saying failure to comply in terms of like they're just not going to treatment? Is that what you mean by failure to comply? Do you mean failure to
comply? Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, Representative Johnson raised a question about making sure there's enough time for someone to comply.
Right, right.
And so the question for me is, well, so what if you don't comply? What happens then?
Right.
I mean, it seems to me nothing has changed in that regard.
No, no. And those are the really difficult cases that courts do deal with. I mean, if a person is struggling with treatment and they're unable to complete treatment, then that's when we try to, you know, increase service, take a different approach with them, get them into maybe a different program. We might even, and in that case, we might have to extend probation. But if a person is failing to comply for other reasons, they're not attending, those become the really difficult cases because, you know, revocation sometimes becomes the only option, and even though it may not be the best option for that individual because it won't help them address their problem.
Director Reitz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So the current law does permit some extensions of probation for failure to complete treatment. The commission's proposal does not change that. In fact, it specifically references that the statute governs extensions.
Representative Jensen, I know you've got, you had a couple other questions, but I want to make sure we're distributing. So I will come back to you. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually did talk to His Honor Kurt Johnson, who runs the drug court in Blue Earth County, and he thought the five-year cap was a good idea and did not see any problems going forward. Wasn't going to actually bring that up until you did. I also talked with state probation officers, MACAC probation officers, and to a person, they were all supportive. My question, however, is could you quickly go through the makeup of the sentencing guidelines, the membership again, please.
So as far as, thank you, Mr. Chair. So as far as who's actually in these seats or?
Please, not their names, okay. But who they are, what they represent.
All right, so the Supreme Court seat actually belongs to the Chief Justice, but to my knowledge, the Chief Justice has never actually served on the commission because the statute permits the Chief Justice to designate someone. The other designee position is the Commissioner of Corrections, which is the opposite situation. The Commissioner of Corrections has always chosen to sit on the commission. Him or herself has never designated someone, at least not for a very long period of time. So those are the two seats that are theirs by virtue of the office, the Supreme Court Chief Justice and the Commissioner of Corrections. The other two judicial seats are appointed by the Chief Justice. Those are the Court of Appeals. It has to be a Court of Appeals judge. And the district court judge. And any of these occupational-related seats cease to become a member of the commission if they lose their job, if you will. So it's tied to their occupation. There's a public defender member, so that person has to be a public defender. The governor selects that public defender member on advice of the public defender's office, the chief public defender. And the county attorney member has to be a county attorney on advice to the governor of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. We already talked about the Commissioner of Corrections, who is a member by virtue of his office or her office. There's a police officer member, again, appointed by the governor, and a probation officer member appointed by the governor. Then there are three members of the public, and I should say all of these members appointed by the governor are coterminous with the governor's term. So, and I'm not aware of any provision in statute for removing them. So the three members of the public, there's no particular qualifications other than one of them has to be a victim of a felony crime. In the past, the governor has, and in fact our current governor has sometimes selected a person who's been experienced with the criminal justice system from the inside, if you will, a person who's been previously convicted, but that is not a requirement in the statute. There are statutory requirements that the governor has to consider certain members of different groups, such as different, you know, diversity has
You've
to
gotten
be
to what I wanted to get to, all right. Thank you, Mr. Chair, is that it would seem to me that the population that is directly impacted by your work and might actually be able to offer some insight into how it's working and how it affected them should be represented on the board. But then you did say the second time that the present governor has somebody that has experienced your work firsthand.
Correct. Although statutorily, correct. Really, thank you, Mr. Chair, really it's just the public defender member who I think is has an interest, has the defendant's interest in mind.
Mr. Chair?
Chair Johnson.
going forward, I think it might be beneficial to have somebody with that kind of insight on the group, just to say, no, that actually didn't work for, at least in my case or something, at least one member that has been impacted directly by your work. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Lodeo. Oh, I'm sorry, Ms. Mitchell. Chair Mitchell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Considine. Actually, in the statutes that set up other commissions around the country, a couple of them do specifically name, you know, formerly incarcerated individual or some identifier along those lines. So it, you know, wouldn't hurt to do that formally for our commission if that's a viewpoint that we want to continue to have on there. I think it is a really valuable viewpoint to have on the commission.
Very well. Members, I'm going to try to get to, not try, I'm going to get to my bill at 3 o'clock. So I still have Representative O'Neill, and I think Representative Johnson still has another question. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to be crystal clear about what we're doing between Representative Long's bill and what you're presenting, because I'm a little bit confused as to what's happening with CRIMSEX 5. So in the delete all, it strikes 609.3451, which is criminal sexual conduct, fifth degree. And then I believe you had an amendment, which, unless I missed it, we didn't move the amendment to the delete all amendment that would reinstate it. And here's my concern. Obviously, many folks around this table have been working on criminal sexual conduct statutes at great length. And I've been in almost every single working group except for two meetings, I believe. So there is a lot of talk about rewriting the whole, obviously they're trying to rewrite the whole chapter because it's very confusing. And I know when you presented, you had the grid, and I don't think I followed it all. The flow chart was really confusing as to, you know, should you be charged with 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5? And then there was a lot of conversation about, well, somebody might be charged with 1, but plead down, charged with 3 and plead down. So my concern is, are we striking this? Are we not striking this? Is it included? Is it not included? Because CRIMSEX 5 is incredibly important to include, because it's very likely that they pled down to 5 and they didn't actually commit 5.
Representative O'Neill, it's a great question. There is a good answer to the language before us, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative O'Neill. So the intention is to include it. That's why we had the amendment, but I was told that since we're laying it over till Thursday, we'll take up the amendment then. That was that was the request. So we're not moving it today. I think we're laying it over, and then the amendment will be taken up.
Yeah, we didn't meet deadline with that particular amendment. So we want to make sure the language is correct, but I think it's really important that you highlighted what you highlighted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, it's incredibly important that CRIMSEX 5 is included in the exception, I guess is the best way to put it, because you have to understand that they probably didn't commit 5. They probably committed something much more egregious. Maybe they did, maybe they didn't. But in the conversations that we had around the table, multiple days, multiple weeks, multiple months now, there was a lot of conversation about, well, we charge here, but they'll plead down. And, you know, 90 to 95% of cases are pled. So they're already getting a downward departure through the plea. And then if we're compressing and shortening probation, that's essentially another downward departure. And I know that Brandon Stolf, that used to be at the Star Tribune, now is at Carol Levin, had done another study of downward departures, specifically with CRIMSEX, and they found upwards around 25% were additionally downward departed after the already plea agreement, which was a downward departure in essence. So you're really talking about very little consequence for a very egregious crime. So I want to make absolutely crystal clear what we're doing, because we want to protect victims. Already they don't get justice. You know, if you looked at the 2 years of information, or excuse me, 2 years of police report that were investigated and looked at, there was a conviction rate from the report all the way to the end of about 7%, which sounds small. And, you know, nationwide, it's about 1%. So we already have a terrible track record for getting justice for women that have been horribly violated. And I would hate to have this pile on top of them to yet further victimize them. So I want to make crystal clear that we are including CRIMSEX 5 for those reasons.
I'm with you, Representative O'Neill, and we will certainly, it's certainly my intent that when we come back with this bill that we address that issue in that way. And I think I see Representative Long nodding his head in agreement as well. So, Representative Johnson, I guess you've got, oh, Representative Adams. So hold on. So I want to get to my bill at 3 o'clock, Jeff. So Justin, you get the last word for today on this, and then we're going to move quickly.
I want to ask a question, make a little short comment. Unfortunately, I have a lot of problems with the what was passed by the Sentencing Guidelines Commission to take into effect in August. It's issues that we studied and we debated last year. Listening to the witnesses, it wasn't 5 years before they things turned around in their lives. It was closer to that 7 to 9 year range. And the studies I've looked at and I've read, it's the range is 5 to 7 years. I'm disappointed that the sentencing guidelines took the low end of it instead of the higher end, where if somebody's doing fine, they could be released from discharged from probation. But the other big concern I have, and even the Attorney General's office wrote on this and made the Sentencing Guidelines Commission aware of it, that at the November meeting, that they violated their own rules and, where's my notes here? They violated their own rules. They overexceeded their statutory authority, and that was by the Attorney General's office. So I think this committee needs to actually go through, remove what they did that's supposed to go into effect in August, and take a deep dive into it and make sure when we do this right, not only to make sure that those on probation succeed, but also to make sure that that we're protecting the victims as well.
Representative Johnson, one, I look forward to seeing the data that you referenced. We keep tossing around and references the data, and so I think it's certainly appropriate when we revisit this issue that we're forthcoming with that kind of data. Ms. Mitchell, very quickly, because there was an AG's opinion that was issued here, so perhaps if you could tell us for the record what that opinion was, and what that caused the commission to do at that point.
Ariane and Representative Johnson, the original proposal that was in front of the commission in November was a hard cap on probation. It didn't allow for a departure. And by doing that, normally the guidelines work within the statutory maximum punishment that the legislature establishes. So the hard cap didn't work because there was room between 5 years and the stat max that could not be accessed by the court in appropriate cases. So that's what the Attorney General's opinion told us, that type of a guideline was overstepping authority. By the time we got that opinion, though, we had already changed the proposal to build in the departure option for the court, and that is how the guidelines traditionally work. We set something lower than the stat max to say this is where we think the appropriate range of sentencing is, but court, you can individualize that based on substantial and compelling reasons with the departure if necessary. So the proposal that we have out there now does comply with the authority that the commission has.
Very well. Representative Long, we're going to lay over House File 689. And hopefully we'll get back to it sometime sooner in the session rather than later, and then we'll be able to address the amendment language in an appropriate manner at that time. So we're laying over House File 689. Thank you, both Chair Mitchell and Director Wrights. Oh, actually, why don't you stay there, just in case there are any questions. You know what? I'm gonna work from here just to save some time. I mean, give you the gavel. We'll do it this way.
All right, Chair Mariani, you have House File 3157 before us today.
Madam Chair, members, I move House File 3157, and my intent is to lay this over as well, but the motion is to refer this, and I want to make sure I get this right to government ops. I think we can do that under the new rules.
Very good. All those in favor, say aye. No, we don't. Okay, I was. Okay.
We're just putting in a motion.
Okay, good. So good. Very good.
It's before us. So, very simply, members, House File 3157 is actually a drawing of a bill, calling of a drill, of a bill. Holy cow! I got mush on my mind with drones. It's a clone of a bill I had earlier this, or rather last year, and really quite simply. It seeks to place the Sentencing Guidelines Commission directly into our state constitution. Of course, the only way you can do that is through a referendum of the people. And the intent here is really to preserve the future independence of this body. When we first established this commission decades ago, it was really with the wisdom, and you have to really, I do anyway, think about the incredible sense of service and humility that members, and my understanding is members from both sides of the aisle, and then it was repeated across the country through many states. But their approach was recognizing that the kind of pressures that happens when you're elected official relative to legislating sentences, criminal sentences. Sometimes it's so much that it overcomes some other sensibilities and the ability to balance out what it takes to preserve public safety, number one, always, but two, what it takes to overcome the biases that all of us carry to some degree or another. And so clearly public servants were worried about and continue to be worried about to this day the way that racial and class biases in particular play out in all our legislative work. But quite frankly, when we're talking about legislation that is about the liberties that we have to be free from state physical control of our bodies, that then raised the need to come up with something that really balances those political pressures that exist in the real world for those who, of us who are elected. And so folks were wanting not to succumb to political pressures of retribution as the only thing that was driving what they were called to do relative to having a good correction system. So we established the Independent Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and over the course of its work, they continue to strive to make their constitutional duty to pass guidelines in sentencing that balance the approach that the legislature had to this area of law. We always preserve, because we can't wave this away, our right, our duty, our paramount duty, to pass a statutory law that could, in fact, countermand and be opposite of what the such a commission would do. But we've often have resisted doing that. However, we haven't, and it concerns me. We certainly have seen a history here, where there have been attempts to diminish the autonomy and independence of this body. Just the mere action of doing that concerns me, because it could send a chilling effect to the commission members, to the commission, that impedes their ability to carry out the duties that are vested in them by state law. And so the intention here is to lift the exact same language that we have under the mission of the commission, because I think that's working well, and to make sure that we provide the necessary protection from over-intrusion and over-pressure on the part of this commission. And that's really my only intent. It's not changing the mission, expectations of the commission as much as an attempt. And, you know, we can debate whether it's a good attempt or a sloppy attempt, but it's really an attempt to make sure that we resist our own urges to put overbearing legislation that then undermines what we set out to do many decades from here. So that would then be offered as a constitutional question for the people of Minnesota. So, Madam Chair, that's basically it. I'd be glad to, in the few minutes that are left, entertain any questions and or comments that my colleagues would have on this.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Mariani, I hear what you're saying, but I have a question, but kind of with a little bit of a comment to put some scope on it behind. But my question is going to be if this is codified, if this is put into the Constitution, does that change in any way the legislature's ability to address these things? Now, here's the reason why I bring that up. I hear what you're saying, but I kind of disagree with one point. And that's that I believe that we're a representative government. And it is very important that even with the bias that us individual elected people have, that's what makes our system work so well. And what I see in this and what I heard from you in this is kind of towards, I'm going to say kind of harshly to make my point and for brevity, but kind of like we shouldn't be bothering the bureaucracy with elected representatives' influence over what it is, the work that they're doing. And I think that's reverse of the way that we should do things here. I think that our bureaucracies should always be subject and answerable to the elected people. Why? Because we represent the people in our district and the people of Minnesota. So if there is a tendency for, like this commission, to feel burdened by the representatives that are in this room and in the House and Senate, I consider that to be a good thing, not a bad thing. I think that's the system that we have set up so that our government is most answerable to the people. And so I just want to make sure that I understand what you're trying to do. I just want to make sure that this body and the Senate, if this were to be put into the Constitution, would still have the ability. I don't want to find out later, well, we can't do this because it's in the Constitution. We can't bring this bill forward because it's in the Constitution. So can you address just that for just a moment? That's my concern.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, we agree more than way more than disagree. I have to say, you know, as a legislator, I actually jealously guard and defend the people's body relative to the other two branches of government, I think we have a optimal duty to be the voice and the actor of the people, and I'm not going to give that up. The intent here is that our ability to veto a decision emanating from such a body doesn't change, and that's why I didn't muck around with the language in terms of its mission and its scope. I don't think we even have the ability to waive our constitutional requirement relative to enacting law that would supersede any bureaucratic decision making. That is currently how it's supposed to be working. Representative Johnson alluded to earlier that one approach is to for us to pass legislation that would undo the pending decision of the commission. I don't think we should do that, but we certainly do have that right and that power, and nothing in this proposal would change that.
Chair Johnson.
Chair Adelson, Chair Mariani. I have a concern on this. Commission's enabling legislation specifically states that the guidelines are advisory to the court, not a mandate, an advisory. However, the language does not appear in your constitutional amendment. I'm just wondering why since they were just advise the court on what their recommendations were, not to tell the court what to do, but to advise the court. Why was that left out?
Representative Johnson, this proposal was constructed with the current existing language that establishes established the commission and set out its mission. If there's a construct in the language that departs from that, then I would gladly adjust the legislation accordingly. We're not going to move this piece today, and so there's certainly time to do that. But I'm giving you my intention relative to the question, the issue that you've asked.
Chair Johnson. Representative Johnson.
Chair Edelson, Chair Mariani. Unfortunately, what you have in this does not say that. It says the commission may establish appropriate sanctions for offenders. Any modification, amending the sentencing, including severity levels and criminal history scores, which they should do. But it doesn't say anything about advising the courts. So, I have a lot of concerns with it. And I myself don't think that the sentencing guidelines should be in the Constitution. They are part of government. They're underneath the courts. And actually, we're established to do what our job was supposed to do.
Chairman.
Representative Johnson, I respect your opinion. I have no intention of us giving away, I don't think we can, our duty under the Constitution. Again, my construct of this bill was to keep it exactly the same as we currently have. And, this commission exists under state law. What frankly disturbs me is that while we've had generations of legislators who have applied humility and balance relative to getting powerful guidance from an independent body, understanding what we ourselves are subject to when dealing with the liberties of individuals, that nonetheless there are individual legislators who would move to undermine the ability of such a body to do its work. And so it seems to me that this would be the best way to then protect against that. Perhaps the better response here relative to this bill is for us legislators to enter into constant ownership and acceptance of the importance of having this independent body, as opposed to pressuring it to do our work. Remember, we always have a legislative veto over decisions of this commission. And so creating situations where we're cowering a body from giving us our best advice is not only wrong, it's absolutely unnecessary. But we'll certainly look at the construct of the language to make sure that it meets the intent before us, but I'm telling you what my intent is.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Chair Ellison. So in the Sentencing Guidelines Commission's presentation, you laid out, I think, really well the goal of the Guidelines Commission, which is to make it an independent entity that is able to assess facts and evidence and help provide guidance to the courts. I think we all share that goal. I know that there's been efforts in the past to try to nonetheless influence the commission to take action in particular directions, including proposing changes to the structure of the commission or the authority of the commission. And I'm curious if in the past, if you are able to speak to this, if that's had a dampening effect on the commission being willing to move forward with particular action, which seems counter to the intent of creating the commission in the first place.
If
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Long. So I asked if I could answer because a couple of years ago before Ms. Mitchell was the chair, there was a bill to change the guidelines from being a legislative veto, as you said, Mr. Chair, to being a legislative approval. So essentially the commission would make recommendations to the legislature, which the legislature would adopt, which I should say some other states do it that way. I know the commission discussed that bill when it was introduced. I don't ever remember it going beyond me telling the commission that this was happening and the commission saying, thank you for your report and moving on. I don't recall that action in the legislature changed anything the commission did. If it did, I was not aware of it.
Mr. Chair. And I would go back to the drug issue. Because I was the director of this commission, way in the past, more than 5 years ago, and the drug issue was bouncing back and forth between the legislature and the commission even then. And part of the reason why it took so long for the commission to put a solid proposal in front of the legislature was because they were getting very mixed signals from the legislature and some kind of threatening signals, too. So at various times, yes, the sort of relationship that we have with the legislature can put a dampening effect on the decisions that the commission is willing to bring forward. And I would offer up examples of other states where that very thing has happened. Washington's been undercut. Commissions have been completely eliminated in Tennessee and Wisconsin, Louisiana and Florida. And I think we all can look at their prison populations for some of those states and get a sense of what the outcome is for that. So I'm not arguing. The commission obviously hasn't taken a position on this bill, but I do think the independence of the commission is important to maintain however we do that, because we'll have better policy within the state as long as the commission feels like it has the independence to act in the way that it thinks is best, subject to your override, of course.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Neill. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to just address the elephant in the room because Minnesota is a very unique state. We have historically been a unique state. We have historically been a purple state. We do things a little bit differently here because of that. So I know that we need to be incredibly mindful of the minority voice. And my concern is this bill silences the minority voice, and let me explain why I think that. The commission is already established through the legislature, but the governor appoints each and every member. So that's the executive branch. They come up with their recommendations that unless we have a hard no, they go into place. Which means it's a yes, and it automatically goes through. So what does that mean? So that means, like right now, we have one party control in the Senate, we have one party control in the House, and we have the same House and governor control, which is historic in Minnesota. I mean, that's pretty much how it goes. There were the one party controlled 44 years, straight run in the Senate. So we need to be incredibly mindful of the minority voice and not dismiss it. My concern is that we already have a system that's set up that says, hey, you know what, you have to veto this, which means you have to get both House and Senate to agree. It's hard enough when they're of the same party, but when they're of different parties, it is really hard to come together on a bill to say, we're going to not do this. And that, in essence, that silences the minority. That's my concern. Then if you put that into the Constitution, it further silences the minority because pretty sure Minnesota is going to continue to be a purple state. We are the only state in the entire union that has a split legislature. Every other legislature is one party control. We have to be so careful when we talk about silencing the minority. So my fear is that's what this does. Already, just the way that it's set up, it does that, but this makes it even worse. So I know that there was a bill to say, no, we have to approve their recommendations, well, then you actually have to come together to approve some, part, all. And then you're working across the aisle. You're working collaboratively. You're working with the Senate, which has a different culture. That's how legislation should be done. And these are decisions made at the highest magnitude, as you pointed out. This is someone's civil liberties, and it also has to do with victim justice. So I think that we need to be incredibly careful, incredibly cautious when we're talking about even the appearance of silencing the minority here in Minnesota, and I think that's what this bill does.
Chair Mariani.
Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill, I have deep respect for you, and so I'm listening carefully to your words, and I assign them the seriousness and the heaviness that they should be assigned. So I wrestle with those issues as well. I would say that dampening the ability of our independent body is also a serious issue. And so the question is, where do we strike the balance? And whether it's this bill or another approach, I want us to make sure that we're talking about that. So maybe it isn't this approach. But we probably have not had this kind of conversation here for a long time. And we should be having this kind of conversation. Putting ourselves in check, which is what we did a generation ago, was a very wise thing to do. And we did that in such a way that still respected our autonomy, not our autonomy, but our duty relative to the Constitution. So I think we struck a balance. However, there have been actions that caused me to worry about whether or not we've lost that balance. I will always continue to listen to you because I think we've done some very good work and you've offered some very good counsel for me and for this body. But I want us all to be listening to one another, particularly as we make steps that could ruin what was a first of the nation, novel, leading, and continues to provide a good insight for us entity. I don't want us to lose that. So I thank you for your counsel and your advice.
Chair, if I may.
Yes, Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Mariani, I appreciate and respect our working relationship. It's absolutely fabulous. And you've got some stellar members and I across the aisle, and Representative Mueller and I were just talking back in the retiring room during session or just after. And you know, it's interesting. I was looking at the bill introductions, and sadly, a good number of them are partisan. And I know she and I work very hard to not be. And so I don't say this lightly, and I say it from the depth of my heart and what I really see. And I've been here a while, not as long as you. But I appreciate that. I appreciate what you said. I listen to what you say and respect it. I just want to make sure that the minority voice isn't silenced, and, you know, that's who I am today. And even if I wasn't, if I was in the majority, I'd say the exact same thing.
Chair Mariani.
Madam Chair, I would move to lay over House File 3157.
I got so much. No. Oh, it's laid over for possible inclusion then.
Right? Yeah, you just stay silent. Okay. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
Thank
you. Members, thank you for the conversation. Thank you, Chair Mitchell and Director Wrights, for your work, but also for being here today. Members, we will meet again on Thursday. We have a number of bills dealing with emergency management services. Very good bill, so I'm really looking forward to that conversation at that time. So until then, we stand adjourned.